This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where we prepare for the horror and the hope. This week, you'll hear one of the most important interviews I have ever done with one of the persons that I consider kind of a god of science. For a couple of decades, I've followed the work of V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution in California. Ram, as he's known, worked with one of his star postdocs, Yang-Yang Shu, to draw the big picture for us. They gathered up 4 decades of Ram's data collection, starting with his participation in the launch of early climate satellites in the 1980s, rolling through the many planes he had scooping up air over India and China, the ocean boys, the works. The result is as huge as any paper James Hansen has ever done. They find that except for the dimming effect of pollution, the Earth energy has already surpassed 1.9 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. That's well above the danger zone. There is a 1 in 20 probability we will go past 3 degrees C by 2050. That is called catastrophe. And this paper looks even beyond catastrophe into the existential threat of the unknown. Knowing that, the pair calculated what we have to do to save ourselves, and they lay it out in 3 great steps. It's difficult, but not impossible, Ramanathan says, to return to 1.5 degrees of warming by the end of this century. In the second half hour, Professor Andy Ridgewell from the University of California, Riverside, joins us to explore the last time Earth warmed by 5 degrees C in a relatively short time. His new paper says that volcanoes, not melting methane, caused the event known as the PETM 56 million years ago. Let's go.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. If you are looking for a roadmap for a catastrophic climate future, this is it. You are on that road. But top scientists are working to find a better, safer future. A new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy outlines both the threat and a hope. I've reached the co-author, the distinguished professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California, Dr. Virab Hadran Ramanathan. Dr. Ramanathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
The title of your new paper is Well Below 2 Degrees C, we'd all like that, Mitigation Strategies for Avoiding Dangerous to Catastrophic Climate Changes. Why did you and lead author Yang-Yang Shu from Texas A&M take on this big paper?
Yeah, I mean, the study took about 3 years to finish. And what we basically did was go back to the data I had collected since the last 35 years. In the early 1980s, I teamed up with NASA to launch a climate satellite, which was, you know, measuring the greenhouse effect directly. And then I'd collected data from ships, from aircraft, from drones, and what have you. When I went back and looked at that data in a series of studies with many of my students, Dr. Shu is also what was my student until 2 years ago. What we found was two disturbing things, that almost everything that was predicted decades ago was coming true. The only exception was that the observed changes were much larger, and we attributed it to feedbacks, complex feedbacks, where many things are pushing the system in the same direction. So that made me realize we need to think about the worst possible consequences, not just the 50% probability value. You know, I think most studies were focusing on the central value of what's going to happen when we increase the greenhouse gases. So when we focused on this low probability, that is about 5 to 10% probability of things happening, we found disturbingly large changes, projected large changes. So then I had to go to the literature of how economists and social scientists call things as catastrophic to existential threat. So we both mapped these types of risk classifications on our data. This is Dr. Shu and myself. And we were sort of forced by the data to call these risks by proper names, and that is there is a 5% probability that in about 30 plus years from now, climate change could become catastrophic. So then you ask, what do we mean by catastrophic? It is in the same sense we call hurricanes as catastrophic. When they hit you, you just don't have time to adapt or to cope with it. Same way, the changes which we are projecting, again, we are projecting to be a 5 to 10% probability of happening. They'll be too fast and too large for many of us to adapt. And the other thing is that many studies are projecting, you know, this so-called catastrophe is when tipping points happen. And one thing I wanted to caution your readers, when I say 5% probability, the tendency to think, why focus on these low probability events? Let's just focus on this 50% probability, which IPCC is focusing on. My response to that is 5% is 1 into 20 odds of what we are saying will happen. We wouldn't, you know, get on a plane with those kind of odds. So 5% probability is not that low a probability. If it happens, it could be disastrous.
So you are the pioneer in the dimming effects of aerosol pollution, like the Asian brown cloud that hangs over northern India and parts of China. Isn't it ironic that if we clean up the air, the Earth could warm even more? Should we be glad we have air pollution for now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Just to clarify that, there are two types of aerosols. One type, you know, which comes from coal combustion, like sulfates, or from your car's nitrates. Yeah, they do have a cooling effect on the planet. But then there are other aerosols, like soot, coming from diesel. They are potent global warming agents. For example, a ton of the soot can have the same warming effect as 2,000 tons of carbon dioxide. That's first. But when you add up all the warming and cooling aerosols together, it is true they are having, you know, a sort of a slight cooling effect. But the flip side of that coin is these same particles kill over 6.5 million people every year from heart disease, blood pressure, cancer, etc. So they are deadly toxic pollutants. The second thing is, while they do have a cooling effect, by dimming, by cutting sunlight going into the ocean, they cut down rainfall. So we, in fact, attributed this 15 years ago, the dimming effect to decrease in the monsoon rainfall. There was quite a bit of skepticism from scientists, particularly scientists from India about this. But now the government institutions in India, scientists are publishing, yes, the monsoon has slowed down because of this particular pollution. So we're all converging on the same thing. Just to give you one more deadly effect of this soot, Dr. Xu, you know, who was my co-author, this was his PhD thesis. He showed the soot from India and China depositing on the glaciers contributes 50% to the melting of all the glaciers we are seeing in the Tibetan Himalayas. So these, we should not get fooled by the so-called cooling effect of these aerosols.
Well, let's get to the paper where you describe three categories of warming risk from 1.5 degrees to 5 degrees or more. Can you talk about those categories as you outlined them?
Yeah. The global climate community, particularly the United Nations and this UN-organized IPCC, which is a group of over 1,000 scientists, they've already, concluded warming anything beyond 1.5 to 2 degrees is dangerous. So it's called dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Okay, so that was already there. They have put it at 2 degrees, but we moved it to 1.5. And then the next category, we put from 3 to 5 degrees as catastrophic. We were motivated to call any warming in excess of 3 degrees catastrophic from the following consideration. There was research suggesting that warming in excess of 3 degrees would cause tipping points. You know, things like a major die-down of the Amazon forest or rain system, shifting, disrupting, weather disruptions. And then there was another, you know, what I think was the pivotal study, which made me become bold enough to call it catastrophic and then beyond fires, beyond catastrophic, is the following. They showed that a warming up about 4 degrees would expose 70% of the population. Remember, we are now talking about beyond 2050, the population of around 10 billion, so it'll be 7 billion people would be exposed to deadly heat. And they defined what that means, that if you stay outside for more than several hours, you could die from it. And then there was other studies pointing out when the planet gets warmer than 4 degrees, about 2.5 billion people would be exposed to viruses which are not known in northern countries, you know, chikungunya, dengue, so on, but 26 viruses. So it is this impact on the natural system. And more than that, I was prejudiced by the impact on human beings. So that's what made us think of these three categories.
Now, just before we get to the solutions—and they are very important—did I read this paper correctly in you are saying there is a low risk, but it is possible that we could even reach 3 degrees C warming by 2050?
Yes. It's not a low risk. It's a high risk, but low probability. So high risk, low probability. That is, it has a low probability of happening, about 1/20 chance of we exceeding, hitting 3 degrees in the next 35 years. But it poses high risks in the sense that it could become catastrophic if we allow it to happen.
Well, let's get to some of the brighter news in this paper. You propose three levers that humans could pull to veer away from climate disaster. Let's take one at a time. First, what do we need in terms of becoming carbon neutral? What do we have to do to get results, and when?
Well, you know, so there are three levers. The first lever is that we go to zero pollution of carbon dioxide, which is what we call carbon neutral. And more than 80% of the carbon emissions comes from fossil fuel combustion, burning of coal, oil, and gas. Interestingly, the solution is extremely simple to say, which is you convert all the end users to electricity, your home heating, your cooking, and your dishwashers, everything, convert to electric appliances. And your cars, too, electric cars, and generate electricity using renewables. You've got five options. Solar, it'll work. If you're living in the, you know, 40 degrees latitude north to 40 degrees south, there is abundant sunshine. That's where, by the way, 2/3 of the population live. And wind, the northern latitudes, you have wind. And hydropower, California is 25% is hydro. And geothermal. Scandinavians use geothermal heat. And, of course, if nothing else works, nuclear. So we have tremendous options. But I recognize just saying convert all uses, end use electricity looks very simple. It's not that easy, but we are facing catastrophic problems. The difficulties of these solutions pale compared to the catastrophe. And, you know, just to give one more example to you, there is less than a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of your house burning in fire, but we all take fire insurance, right? I'm talking about 1 in 20, not in 1 in 1,000,000. So that is the carbon neutral. And again, one can say, you know, Ramanathan is, you know, his head is in the sky, he's talking about pie in the sky. No, California, San Diego, the city I live in, we have a Republican mayor, and we are going to go carbon neutral for our energy generation in about 15 to 20 years. So the technologies are there. The second thing with the problem in just relying on carbon neutral is that carbon dioxide, once it's in the air, stays for 100 years. So it's going to be slow acting. We need something fast and quick. For that, we need to pull on the second lever. We call it short-lived climate pollutants. There are four of them, methane, which comes from natural gas and from cattle, paddy field, etc. and black carbon, which is soot coming from burning wood or burning coal or burning oil. And then there are hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, used as refrigerants. These refrigerants, a ton of them, when it escapes into the air, has the same effect as 2,000 to 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide. The beauty of these short-lived climate pollutants is that they stay in the air only for weeks to 10 years. So if you pull that lever, their effects are gone within a few weeks to about 10 years, so we can get an immediately cooling effect on the planet. Okay? So the carbon dioxide is hugely difficult. So you use your stronger hand, in my case it's my right hand, to pull the CO2 lever. And with my weaker hand, I pull the short-lived climate pollutant. It's easier. The trick, the key thing is we have to do it now. We can't wait for 10 years. We are running short of time.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my distinguished guest, Dr. V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution at the University of California. Now, you do talk about a third lever, which we may or may not pull, and that is carbon extraction and sequestration. As far as I know, there is no working CES tech on a commercial scale on the planet today. Can we place any hope in a technology we don't have yet?
It's a good question. So when do we need to pull the third lever? That if the entire world has to do this, so if instead of doing it now, let's say it takes 10, 15 years for it to do that, in the meantime, we would have put another 500 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the air. Okay? So we have to take it out. Any delay in mitigating, pulling lever in one and two would cost us trillions of dollars in taking that CO2 toxic pollutant out of the air. And I absolutely agree with you. There is no scalable technology, but our hope is a study like ours, pointing out the catastrophic consequences of inaction, would motivate engineers, technologists, chemists, and biologists to figure out how to take that CO2 out of the air.
I wonder if it's a coincidence that as scientists with Indian and Chinese roots, you two ask the question seldom raised, climate change more dangerous for whom? Tell us why that is so important.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for asking this question. That's the one which is of most immediate concern to me, which is that about 50 to 60% of the pollution is from the wealthiest 1 billion people from around the world. And there are 3 billion people, the poorest 3 billion, they are still burning firewood and dung and anything they can get their hands on to even cook their food. So they're still relying on 18th century technology. So when we face severe drought, severe floods, storms, sea level rise, the existential threat is going to come to them first. And while I don't know that, I can't predict exactly when that's going to happen, I personally wouldn't be surprised if climate change becomes an existential threat to this 3 billion people in the next 15 to 20 years.
And getting back to the danger of our situation now, you talk about existential threats lurking in this carbon bomb. And does existential imply the possibility of even human extinction if the climate warms above 5 degrees C very quickly?
I mean, we certainly can't rule out. I don't know the entire population, but, you know, billions. Because what we have not talked about yet is independent of climate change scientists, ecologists, and paleontologists are pointing out, based on detailed analysis, that there is, you know, a major extinction ongoing just like because of habitat destruction, losing biodiversity, right? Clearing forests, putting our houses, etc. And now on top of that, they are saying climate change could expose 20% to more of the species to extinction. So now you add this exposing humans to deadly heat stress, deadly viruses, sea level going up, with mass population migrating away from, you know, damaged areas, and then you bring in the extinction of species. We rely on them. So we could not but, conclude beyond 5 degrees poses existential threat. But in our classification, we put two question marks. And our expectation and hope is that by bringing this possibility of existential threat out of our closet, most of us, we are worried about this, into the front page, we will do more careful analysis of what does it really mean to our existence. The question is out there, and we felt compelled by the data to bring it up. I don't think natural scientists have thought in these words, or, you know, this is just simply not in my lexicon, as if I'm a physicist. But we had no option but to put this category out there.
You know, one of my concerns is, will we really realize when catastrophe arrives? I mean, we've just seen record hurricanes wiping away Caribbean islands and drowning East Texas. At what point do we say, yes, this is the first stage of catastrophe?
I am glad you asked that question. But now I'm going to speculate, all right? Based on our paper, we are showing that we are going to exceed the threshold of dangerous climate change, is 1.5 degrees, in another 15 to 20 years. Okay? By then, the changes will be so clear to everyone. Everyone would be impacted. This may be too optimistic, but I'm certainly expecting when we cross that 1.5 degrees, there will be a hue and cry from every person in the world, including the United States, for immediate action.
Well, I've been waiting for that, and I keep thinking, well, when the Arctic ice melts back, surely everyone will react, but I don't know what it's going to take. I hope you're right. You do say that climate science alone can't just stick to pure physics and atmospheric chemistry. Why do scientists have to include society and social choices now as well when we try and project climate change?
You know, this was an independent report I did 2 years ago, from 50 scientists from all 10 campuses of the UC system. We had theologians, we had social scientists, we had political scientists, and we had, of course, climate scientists and engineers. And we said, what are the top 10 solutions which is going to take to get us out of this mess? I was not surprised, I was excited, but I was not surprised when these 50 scientists concluded societal transformation is our solution 2 and 3. Without societal transformation, we are not going to solve this problem. At some point, we have to stop asking about the economics of it, but we start thinking about the common good of destroying people's lives and destroying the planet.
Well, finally, I'd like to ask you something about what I call the paralysis of climate doom. Even reading your paper, by the time I got through the abstract and those helpful introductory boxes, I was so overwhelmed by the awful possibilities, I had trouble concentrating on the solutions you offered. Is there a problem getting solutions going when we are facing such a huge danger?
You know, these were all buried in the last page. The shining bright light in the sky, or the lining in the silver lining in the clouds, is that the climate mitigation train has already left. There are 53 cities around the world embarking on carbon neutrality. There are 65 industries who have started on this. And so I call them living laboratories. And on the front of this group of living laboratories is California and Sweden. You know, both of them have cut down their carbon emissions. Of course, Sweden a lot more, by 20%, compared to California, 6-7% in the last 9 years. As they were doing it, their GDP grew significantly. So that sort of put to rest this nagging worry. Cutting carbon emissions is going to destroy our economy and send more people to poverty houses. No, both countries have flourished. And the second thing is renewable energy is now employing 8.1 million people around the world. And as you know, just last month, China said there will be no more fossil fuel cars after 2040. And China was, you know, preceded by UK and France. And California is going to have at least 2 million electric cars. So things are happening. But I must say, while I'm excited by it, the pace is not fast enough. We have to, you know, really do a lot more drastic action, but we are not starting from zero.
As we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
No, you asked some very, very insightful, pointed questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Dr. V. Ramanathan. He's quite famous in science, a pioneer in research, and a distinguished professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. His latest paper with Yang Shu from Texas A&M University is Well Below 2 Degrees, Mitigation Strategies for Avoiding Dangerous to Catastrophic Climate Changes. It is a must-read, and the authors have made sure you can access it for free in full, as published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dr. Ramanathan, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. When it comes to rapid global warming, the best example we have happened around 56 million years ago. The planet warmed up around 5 degrees C in less than 5,000 years, which is very fast in geologic time. To know what can happen now, we badly need to find out about a rapid warming event called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM. With no humans burning fossil fuels, what happened? The best guess was that frozen methane on the seafloor reached a tipping point and came burping up into the atmosphere as major warming gases. That was the story I accepted, until a revolutionary new paper was published in the journal Nature on August 30th, 2017. We've reached a co-author of that paper, Dr. Andy Ridgewell. He's a former roads and trees activist in rural Devon. Andy got his doctorate in the UK at the University of East Anglia. After research in Canada, Ridgewell became a professor at the University of California, Riverside. He specializes in biogeochemical modeling and climate change. Andy Ridgewell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I didn't actually know that you would dig up my long-ago previous history as a tree hugger.
No tree hugger gets off without being mentioned here. We love tree huggers. Okay, so now, I think this paper is a breakthrough. Why don't we start? What was the situation here on Earth before the PETM event? What was it like?
Hot. Sea level was high. There were no ice sheets. A friend, previous colleague, now unfortunately deceased, once to the New York Times when pressed on, what was it like? He said it was hot as hell and there were mosquitoes the size of your head. I think the size of your head, but it's not quite correct, but hot as hell.
Right, so it started from a very hot position, and without going into the causes yet, how do we know there was a big, fast warming around 56 million years ago, even from that hot point?
That's a good question. So, I mean, the instrumental record stretches back to the 1800s, and we're looking back now 55 million years, so we have no thermometers or anything like that. Dinosaurs have been dead by 10 million years, so we're at least post the big asteroid impact. We have to resort to a whole bunch of tools that involve lots of careful and high-tech lab work, which I don't actually do myself. I leave all that hard work to others. There are changes in the ratio between different elements recorded in microscopic shells that settle to the bottom of the ocean. You can drill down into the mud at the bottom of the ocean. You can find these tiny organisms, or the shells of them, called foraminifera. One of the things that people look at is the ratio between magnesium and calcium, and that changes as a function of the temperature they grow in. Another thing that changes as a function of the temperature they grow in is oxygen isotopes. So now you're measuring the same element, oxygen, but you're looking at the ratio between different masses. People have got increasingly clever. There are bugs that live in the ocean which adjust the fluidity of their cell membrane according to temperature. And some of these compounds are preserved in the sediments, and so you can measure the different compounds. There's some more things like this. So there are a whole variety of different, we call them proxies, because we don't have a direct measure of ancient temperature, but we have some measure that we can relate to temperature. There are a whole bunch of different measures, and they all give a sort of consistent 4 to 6 degrees of global warming across this event.
Now, before I ran into your paper, scientists had suggested that methane clathrates were the most likely cause of this heating event called the PETM, and so we should worry about clathrates today.